Hello all, welcome to the God Said of Us podcast. This is Patrick Barney. I'm the editor of Kai Draconis Books. The God Said of Us podcast is a content channel of Kai Draconis Books, which is an indie anarchist press that publishes socially engaged or socially conscious literature. You can go to our website, xidraconis.org, to check out the 5 books that we've published so far in our 2 years of existence. All the books that we publish are free to readers. So if you want a free book, just go to our website, read the synopses of what we've published. And if anything strikes your fancy, send us an email and we'll send you a copy. Or you can get ebook copies, digital copies right away. So I'm here with my podcast partners. I'm no longer running things. These guys are really running things right now. They edited the last 2 podcasts, which I appreciate. Hans Berger and Chris Malmberg. Today was my pick, and I've been thinking about choosing this novella for a long time. So I decided to choose Albert Camus' The Fall, which is a really tricky, but really, from my perspective anyway, engaging novella. And also, I asked you guys to read a piece of supplemental lit crit. And we don't have to talk about that directly. We can if you want. I mostly wanted to ask you guys to read the supplemental piece of lit crit, which is Betrayal of the Witness by Shoshana Fellman, because, I wanted to, just to give you guys some theoretical background, in case it helped. So where should we begin? Does anybody have any ideas? Any questions?
Yeah. I mean, I found this, I think your summation of it at the beginning of the podcast as engaging but baffling. Is that roughly what you said?
Yeah, I'm not sure I used exactly those words, but I think I characterized it that way.
Yeah, it's a very enjoyable read. In the course of reading it, I kept stumbling on sentences and thinking, oh, that's the thesis, that's the idea, right? And folding that page down, and then a little bit later stumbling on something else and thinking, oh, that's it, that's the thesis, right? And I never was really able to quite pin anything down,
Right.
I guess the... Maybe what might serve as sort of an initiating question, at least. I think the answers, there may be easy answers, but maybe this will give us some momentum. What is the fall that is referenced in the title? Where does that title come from?
Well, to my mind, it references all of the falls we can think of in the novel. So the fall. Referring to the suicide of the woman on the sign. So Clemence's, or, that's not how you pronounce it because he's French, but I'll just say Clemence because otherwise I feel like I'll say it stupidly. Clemence's, fall from Parisian lawyer and philanthropist to, this, just kind of weird guy at a bar in Amsterdam, and whatever whatever other fall that we can think of, and there's actually good precedent for that interpretation in Camus' Oeuvre. So a story in his collection of stories, Exile in the Kingdom, in French is La Haute or La Haute. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, but interestingly enough, it can be translated both as the guest and the host. And the story revolves the story revolves around a French teacher living in the Algerian desert who is told that he has to escort a Berber man to the nearest town for murder, to be tried for murder. And so the whole question is who is the guest and who is the host? Is the Frenchman the host because it's like his home, or is the Frenchman the guest because he's in Algeria and the Berber, the Arab man, is actually the host? You know, so there's ambiguity is you know, part of his oeuvre, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Yeah. So you said all the falls in the novel. There's the fall of the narrator, who I thought of as Jean-Baptiste,
because sure.
I think that's the last his assumed last name, and the interpretive essay that we read, of course, attached some significance to him calling himself a variation on John the Baptist,
right?
But there's Jean-Baptiste's fall from being a respected attorney and philanthropist. There is the a jump off a bridge that he passes by. Are there other falls that occur within the novel?
Mm.
Or is it really kind of the ambiguity between those two that characterizes the title?
Trying to think if what other falls actually occur. You know, I'm assuming that the interlocutor actually will come back to Jean-Baptiste at the end. Like, after the novel is over, I assume he will visit Mexico City again, which is to say we could say that there is a possible fall of the interlocutor. But that wouldn't...
In the sense that he is... There's a fall of the interlocutor because he is... seduced in some sense by the nihilism of Jean.
Right. Exactly.
I had a question kind of attached to that while you're thinking about the number of falls. How many times have you read this, Patrick?
I think this is the fourth time.
I was curious because there's the interlocutor, as you say, is given nothing to define, like... I'm curious, has your understanding of the person to whom Clements is speaking changed as you've read it? Or, like, is it you? Is it the reader?
I've entertained different ideas. Some critical literature on this novella places a lot of emphasis on this idea of the interlocutor. And, you know... especially, like, I read a book, I forget what it was called, it wasn't very good, but the author of the book just, you know, wanted to emphasize this idea of, I think, reader response theory, and saying, like, the interlocutor is meant to be, you know, the reader of the novel. But that doesn't make sense to me, because while we're given very little information, we do receive some information. You know, there's an indication that he's also from Paris and that he's also a lawyer. There's the question of whether Jean-Baptiste is reliable or not. But assuming that he is reliable, which, you know, I'm not sure that he is, but just for the sake of argument,
assuming that he's at least reliable in the assertion that the interlocutor is a French attorney.
Right.
If not other things,
exactly. So that theory doesn't strike me as very good. I think technically this is one of the most interesting questions about the novel. You know, what role does this interlocutor play? And I'm not quite sure. I've read it four times, as I said, and I'm not sure about much.
But you are convinced that the interlocutor is affected.
Yes, I do believe that. I think that I do think he's affected by the story. I do think that he's going to, you know, when I just get the feeling when I, every time I read it, I get the feeling that he is going to come back. Like Jean-Baptiste has been successful in, you know, his task of judge penitence, this, which is a pretty important concept that I assume we'll talk about. But, you know.
So what is it then that, what is it then that precipitates, and to some extent, I mean, this is maybe partly a matter of summary and partly a matter of interpretation, or maybe the answer to this question kind of blurs summary and interpretation, right? But what is it that precipitates Jean-Baptiste's fall from his position of wealth and prominence and respect in Parisian society? Why does he fall?
You know, when I think about it, I don't recall any specific. Wait.
There's not like a precipitating event, right? It's more that he begins to question all the ideas and assumptions that support that position and finds them all insupportable on examination.
Right.
Am I characterizing that?
Yeah, I would say yes. The incident of the motorcycle guy, I think that is the point at which he really begins to question. So it's you know, where he asks the guy to move along, and he thinks he's being polite, and you know he believes he's in the right, and yet everybody around him seems to think that he's being an asshole, and he even ends up getting sucker punched by the motorcycle guy, I believe, or swung at or something like that.
Right. Mm. Right. There's the maybe a crisis partly precipitated by the motorcyclist who stopped in the intersection, maybe partly precipitated by his experience of the woman on the bridge. But what is it about, you know, when we say that he, I mean, I said a moment ago that he kind of starts to question the assumptions that underlie his role and his position. And I'm trying to remember what the questioning is that he makes of those ideas or assumptions, right? Like in some sense, he sort of talks himself out of believing all the things that are necessary to maintain his social position.
Right.
And what is it that he says or does to talk himself out of that? I know part of it is he digs into the question of charity or generosity as he undermines the idea that he can feel any pleasure from charity or generosity other than some sort of selfish that if he acts with charity or acts with generosity or does good things for other people, there's a selfish ego gratification
right.
built into that that undermines his ability to value
right.
it. Is there, you're a lot better with moral philosophy than I am. Is there a larger debate there that he's tapping into or a term for that kind of?
Yeah. Conclusion? I mean, there's definitely, I think what we're, I'm not sure how much importance or how much thinking we're supposed to do about, you know, this particular issue. But yeah, there's always the question of, you know, and I believe it's from, maybe not necessarily from Kant, but he definitely discussed it. You know, he felt that we had to do, for an action to be good, a couple of the criteria that had to be met for an action to be good were that it had to be the right action, but also done for the right reason, right? So if you did the right action for the wrong reason, then the action is immoral. So that seems to be the moral issue we're talking about here, right? Jean-Baptiste understands or comes to the understanding that he may be performing certain right actions, but that he's certainly doing it for the reason that you specified. He you know, wants to gratify himself. He wants to dominate.
He's completely incapable of performing the right actions for the right reasons.
Right.
And or how does that come
to be incapable?
Yeah. And how does that come to a head with the woman on the bridge committing suicide? Like, is it? I'm curious because it feels like John Baptiste does not do anything about it. Is that because he's a coward? Is it because if he did anything about it, it would be out of selfishness for making himself look better and the cost of risking his own life for hers or doing anything about? Let me walk back. How does that come to a head in that experience of the woman jumping
off
the bridge?
Well, I definitely think it's the point. I think it's the catalyst for his, you know, what leads him to his, you know, philosophy that, you know, everybody is guilty and nobody is innocent, and you know, there are no friendships, there are only accomplices. So I definitely think that the incident comes to a head as the catalyst for, you know, him starting to articulate this, you know, as Hunt said, nihilism or nihilism to himself. But why he doesn't do it, I feel like he just doesn't want to put the effort in. Like he's you know, it'd be too cold, you know, like to seriously. That's what he's
well, and no,
that's,
I mean,
what he says at the end of the novel.
And I wonder if to some extent, I mean, maybe it would be too cold is just an excuse,
right?
Not an excuse for some kind of, not that it's an excuse for some sort of underlying deeper motivation to not do anything, but that it's, that there is no reason he doesn't do anything, right? There's no reason he can point to say, well, I didn't. And the absence of a very clear, discernible reason for his inaction is maybe really what sets a lot of that self-questioning.
Right.
The kind of instinctive apathy.
Mm-hmm.
That's so interesting because, I told Patrick before you connected, Hans, that I hadn't read this or any Camus before, and maybe I missed it, but I really read his inaction as cowardice.
Mm.
Like, And his inability to speak about that cowardice as, because he is such a speaker, you know, what he speaks about he has control over. And it seemed as though, to me, I'm just reading it for the first time, that he didn't do anything because he's a coward, because he was scared.
Mm.
But I could be completely wrong about that. Like, is there anything that I missed or any critical response that guides your thinking to say that it's something so banal as he didn't want to get cold?
Yeah.
I mean, even though he says that, but
to be too cold. Well, I mean, it's interesting. It's super interesting because, in The Stranger, there's a murder in The Stranger, and the character, it happens on a beach and there's a lot of sun, and the killer murderer has a gun in his hand, and ultimately when he's put on trial, he says, they ask him, why did he do it? And he said, the sun was in my eyes, you know? So I think it's interesting that, like, there's this excuse, maybe it's an excuse, maybe it's not. There's also this excuse in this other novel by Camus, and so I feel like there probably is reason extra textually to think that it's an excuse, But intertextually, I think that reading him as a coward is okay. I mean, it, you know, like when you going back to the motorcycle incident, you know, he puffs himself up. He says, you know, I could always trust my muscles, you know, but do we believe that? Do we really believe that, you know?
No.
Right.
No, we don't believe
now,
that.
So I think, you know, saying he didn't do it because he's a coward seems okay to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it definitely seems okay to me.
Yeah.
Does that make him a good judge of humanity?
Well, and this is actually what I think what the key ambiguity of the text is, and why I can never puzzle it out, is that, you know, so this, he says a lot of things that I assume we're not meant to take as the ethical standpoint of the novel. Like, you know, everybody should be a slave. Right? You know, I assume.
Yeah, yeah. It's reasonable to assume.
I assume that the novel is not saying, you know, everybody should be a slave. And I assume that the novel is not actually saying that there are no innocent people. But I've been frustrated by the critical literature around this novel because none of them seem to actually grasp that. Like, they often take Jean-Baptiste as a mouthpiece for the ethical standpoint of the novel. And I find that very strange. Like, really? Like, we're actually meant to think that the novel is saying there are no innocent people, everyone is guilty, everybody is condemned. You know, are we really meant to believe that? So I think that there's some, that seems reasonably clear. But at the same time, Jean-Baptiste does say things that, you know, do seem to have some ring of truth. Like, when he, you know, when he says something like, you know, what we can say about humanity is that they fornicated and read the papers, right? You know, it's funny, it's dark, but in some sense you feel like, dude, you hit it. Like, people are just fucking and distracting themselves, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. There's this central ambiguity about judgment. Well, about Jean-Baptiste himself. But also, so to kind of get to your question about judgment, Chris, you know, this idea that, you know, I do think that if you take the nihilistic worldview that Jean-Baptiste has, then, and, you know, in his worldview, being cowardly might actually be moral. Maybe not moral, but if there is no morality, being cowardly is totally fine. And that would make him a decent judge of humanity because, you know, if humanity is all scum and disgusting and we deserve to be slaves, then he is able to inhabit that role by being a coward, you know, and according to him, being a coward, being recognizing that you're scum, recognizing that you're a slave, allows you to gain superiority over others, right? Like, that's what he calls judge penitence.
Because, like, I thought of cynicism and just sort of the belief that selfishness drives everything.
Right.
And again, you might know better about this than me, but it seemed to be that, like, he's basically rendering bravery and cowardice to be a meaningless spectrum.
Right.
Because even if he was going to be doing something for this woman, he would be doing it for himself.
I think that fits with what he thinks. I agree with that.
I'm probably going to oversimplify this question, but I'm trying to form a thought here. So if Jean-Baptiste takes the position that if Jean-Baptiste, through his thoughts about the nature of morality and through his undermining of his belief in his own ability to do things for the right motivation, then arrives at the idea that bravery and cowardice are meaningless distinctions, and that becomes a rationalization for inaction in the face of human suffering. Does the novel then become a critique of overanalysis? Does it become a critique of a particular type of over-rationalization?
I haven't heard it expressed that way, but that seems reasonable to me.
Because it seems like this guy would have been better off if he just hadn't thought too hard about stuff.
I hate to say it
Hans, in just those words, because I feel all... like a freshman in like a world lit, English 200 world lit class going like, well, it seems like all these people would be a lot happier if they just stopped talking about what everything meant and just lived their lives.
Right.
It's very easy to frame that comment in a dumb way, but like, is that his tragic flaw?
Is overanalysis?
Probably not, right? But why not, if not?
I don't know. I've never thought of that. I'm not saying that that's wrong.
You can say it's wrong. I don't mind.
I'm not saying it's wrong. And, there might be things in the text to support that. I think my gut says that I don't think that that is, or at least from my perspective, that doesn't seem exactly right. Just because, it wasn't as if Camus was a, endorsed quietism, he certainly didn't endorse quietism. But that's like the only, and that's outside the text. So I don't know.
Is it about sophistry then? Is it about someone who has some kind of deep-seated corruption in his character and uses analytical techniques to arrive at a standpoint which supports corrupt instincts in
now
his character?
That seems more plausible to me. That definitely seems more plausible to me. If I'm putting this into the context of, as Fellman does, the quarrel between Camus and Sartre, if I'm putting that into the context, one of the things, well, not just in that context, but in a lot of Camus' work, is he resisted the idea of totalization, that if we create a system or we create a total coherent whole, that we can then submit things to that whole and things will turn out okay. And he definitely critiqued that idea. And his main evidence was, like Stalinism. So, sure, on paper, Marxism sounds okay, but this is what people are doing with it. People are, creating Stalinism, So, using a framework to justify, Stalin's gulags. Which is what he accused Sartre of doing. So that makes sense to me, that idea that maybe the book is critiquing, you know, the construction of frameworks to explain and rationalize action.
Huh. Right, right.
That's interesting. That's like, I like that. That's, I think that's like one of the clearest thoughts I've ever had about the novel. And it was your thought. I appreciate that.
Well, you articulated it a lot better than I did, but.
So, I don't know. Do you guys want to specifically address Fellman? Or was that not interesting? Was it boring? What'd you guys think?
Well, I did find it interesting, and I found Feldman interesting, and I found the context that she provided. Am I getting the pronoun it's, right on that?
Yeah, her last name's actually Fellman, not Feldman.
Fellman.
And Shoshana, okay. Yeah, she's a woman.
Fellman. Shoshana Fellman, okay. Yeah, I mean, I thought that the context Fellman provided, it was intriguing, and it had a certain... It resonated to a certain extent. It didn't seem to me to be... It didn't seem to me, at the time I read it at least, to feel totally adequate to explain the whole novel, right? It didn't seem like the key that unlocks the whole piece.
Yeah, she's paying attention to, like, one little piece of the novel, I agree. The idea of witnessing.
Right, she's very interested in the idea of witnessing. I mean, I think that the scene on the bridge is very important, but I think that the level of focus that she maintains just on the scene on the bridge maybe diminishes the importance of the other vignettes. Some of which I think are much stranger and harder to unlock, right?
Yeah, I think I have the same criticism. I definitely think there's a lot of insight in Fellman, but like her attention to this one act as like the main hidden purpose of the novel doesn't strike me as totally successful, especially because, you know, it leaves out the idea of judgment almost entirely, which I think judgment is pretty important to the novel as well.
Well, and it's interesting too because, and I may distort or oversimplify Fellman's argument here, so or the application of it. So feel free to correct this. My understanding of it was that in some sense she was drawing a parallel, or arguing that the novel was drawing a parallel between the ignorance and inaction of the narrator to the plight of the woman jumping off the bridge, and the ways that the allies looked the other way or did not adequately acknowledge the Holocaust while World War II was happening, right?
Yeah.
But she says pretty explicitly that in her analysis that the decision to not adequately acknowledge the Holocaust came from an instrumental perspective, right? If that it was thought that it would not be an effective means of directing resources and attention while they were in fact trying to stop the Holocaust by beating the Nazis, right? And I mean, you can disagree with that maybe on a... There are disagreements that you can have with that, but that's at least a reasonable standpoint for the people taking that action to be coming from. And that doesn't... I mean, ignoring human suffering for instrumental reasons in the larger context of ultimately trying to reduce it seems to me very, very different from what's being illustrated by the vignette on the bridge.
No, I agree. You know, like the question about, you know, not being witnesses to the Holocaust as like a PR move for instrumental purposes, that, you know, that's kind of a question of utilitarianism. Yeah. Like, you know, is it okay to ignore some suffering to reduce greater suffering? Whereas, you know, the woman on the bridge, this is what's at stake there seems to be more about like an ontology, you know, like Jean-Baptiste's ontology, a moral ontology, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting.
And that was one reason I think that, like, the link that she was trying to draw, I don't know that I totally understood or totally agreed with the link that she was trying to draw between the specifics of the novel and the context that it was written in. And that's, I think that your analysis of,
you know,
your analysis. You're going to have to pee in this cup to get the job.
Are there a lot of acid crystals? Anyway, go on.
Your analysis of the kind of broader technique of the narrator being this sort of person who abuses intellectual techniques to support his own personal corruption, as maybe being not a direct representation of, but connected to some extent to Sartre's inability to criticize Stalinism. That has a bit more resonance to
right.
me, right? I don't think that that unlocks the meaning of the novel necessarily, but I think it provides kind of an emotional context for how to feel
right.
about
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Yeah, I have a lot of mixed feelings about film, and, you know, as I said, I think there's a lot of insight, but I also feel weird about her. Like, I definitely feel weird about her choice of, like, it's not exactly hermeneutics of suspicion, because she clearly respects the novel, so, but it's kind of like hermeneutics of suspicion in that she seems to think that what the novel is really about is hidden, right? It's, there's some core in the novel, so it's let's look at, you know, these not minor incidents, but look at these small, like, things that are just kind of said off the cuff, like, you know, how Jean-Baptiste is, like, you know, talks about the liquidation of the Jewish quarter in Amsterdam, and Feldman takes a lot of, thinks that there's something very important about that. And I'm not saying it's not important. I'm just saying that it's the key thing that leads her to the putting it into the context that she does. And I think that there is, in doing that, it might be too strong a move, if that makes sense.
That's fair. Yeah. I mean, I think I like the insights and the context Feldman had, but I feel like if the only thing that you read to try to understand the novel was Feldman, there might be a limit to perspective. This is a little bit of a change of subject,
sorry.
But I just felt like I really wanted to see if we could address this. The sequence where Jean-Baptiste becomes the new pope. in some sense.
Right.
That where there, and my recollection of it, I was trying to flip to it here. I had it in one of my bent down pages. But as I recall, essentially he's in, I think, the army, something
right.
like that, the French foreign
right, right.
maybe. And, or I think he's trying to fight, he's in with some resistance fighters, or I got a little messy on the exact.
I believe it happens after. He was in the army stationed in Africa, and I believe he becomes the new pope when he is in a detainment camp, which
okay.
The reason he's in the detainment camp is because he was associated with a known resistance fighter, even though, but
so,
go on.
And there's this character named Guesclin. I'm sure I'm mangling the pronunciation of that, but Du Guesclin, for lack of the
okay.
right way to say it. And Du Guesclin basically says that he's a bit mad, and then Du Guesclin proposes that he declared to us the need for a new pope who should live among the wretched instead of praying on a throne, and the sooner the better. Yes, he repeated, as soon as possible. And then they he asks who among us has the most failings, and Jean-Baptiste raises his hand as a right. joke. And then the fact that he's willing to admit to that makes him, Duke Guesclin decides that he's the new pope. And I don't think much comes of it other than just sort of this, you know, weird little passing kind of group that they have there. But how does that, I mean, it seems like that's the start of the series of increasingly unhinged rationalizations
right.
that ends with the idea that everyone should be right. a slave.
Well, that's like the first moment when he doesn't realize it yet, but that's like his first moment when he comes up with this philosophy of judge penitence, right? Where you acknowledge your own failings so as to judge others more effectively and to obtain superiority over others. So by acknowledging that he's got failings, even though it's just as a joke, you know, hey, I got failings. I'm scum. I'm the new pope. You know, right? I still crack up when I read this, man. I cracked up. I really think this novel's just hilarious, and I hope you guys thought. I mean, it's like the perfect sense of humor, just totally, totally dark and depressing. Oh, jeez.
I think if I reread it, it would strike me as a lot funnier on a second read.
Right.
Right. Because there's, particularly because like, there's a certain. You know, we've been talking about kind of his rationalizations and his ways of talking himself out of his position, and a lot of those make a certain amount of sense.
Right.
Right? Like the whole question of doing the right thing for the wrong reason, on some level, probably most people have pondered that, whether inside or outside of like a formal philosophical framework, right? Right? That's a well-established question. And there's a period later on where he kind of goes through a series of self-questioning around his motivations for having affairs and realizes that he has romantic and sexual affairs mainly for the purpose of kind of the complete emotional subjection of the other
right.
person and can't enjoy it if he's not achieving that. And again, like that's, I don't think most of us feel that way, but there's a certain logic to
right.
the standpoint. And then there's like this line that gets crossed when he starts talking about being elected the new pope because he's willing to admit
right.
flaws, where things just, it's like there's this change in register there's this change in register from things that are kind of seductive in spite of themselves to things that are just absurd. And I find that deeply, deeply.
Yeah, agreed. Absolutely. Absolutely. Was there a question there? Yeah.
No, there probably
no, I don't,
should have been.
I don't yeah.
there
no,
probably
no.
should have been to keep the discussion
no, no.
going.
That's all right. No, I agree. I personally, the novel's baffling. We're not sure exactly what it's getting at, but I think technically it's fucking amazing. Like the ambiguity of everything, like the technique of the entire novel being spoken to an interlocutor that never speaks and we know very little about, and then this switch in register that you're talking about, Hans, where and the you know the things being like both deeply ironic and therefore hilarious, but also deeply disturbing and horrifying. I don't know. I think it's super good. And now that I think about it,
I'm very glad that
yeah,
I read
I'm
it,
glad
yeah.
You know, awesome. But I actually feel bad now because like I probably shouldn't have started you guys off with Camus' best not work. I should, you know, like I should have started you off with like his something like The Plague, which is fantastic. But it's also, you know, it's also less ironic, more earnest, less ambiguous, more straightforward. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Well, I've read The Stranger and the Plague.
Oh, you have? Actually.
Well, The Plague I read, there was a period before I went, like in the basically like the maybe spring before I went to grad school, I was trying to read a whole bunch of like what I thought were quote unquote smart books to kind of be a little bit better able to hold my own and kind of have that background. So I read some Faulkner, I read some Umberto Eco, I read Calvino, I read J.G. Okay. Ballard, some stuff like that. The Plague was one of the things that I read during that time. I didn't have any kind of background, you know, like I didn't really think that hard about it. I just read it. So I don't know that I understood it particularly well. Like I know what happens in it roughly, but I probably didn't get as much out of it as I could have because I was in a hurry and I wasn't really trying to make any effort to analyze it. And certainly I didn't talk to anybody about it. I also read The Stranger. I think just kind of, like I think I just kind of kept it in the bathroom and read it in the bathroom, you know, and like when we were in grad school, I think I just like I had a copy lying around and I put it in the bathroom to look smart and then ended up actually reading it. And
that's hilarious.
And I do feel like I understood The Stranger reasonably well. I think just because like I knew you at the, partly because like it's not. Maybe I'm going to sound like a terrible idiot to say this or, you know, like a pretentious asshole, but I don't feel like The Stranger is that difficult to decode,
right?
I don't think so either. Meaninglessness, absurdity, things that we do that don't make any sense that are then, you know, other people try to interpret that from their own perspectives and you just get the perpetuation of further nonsense. Everybody knows what The Stranger is about. The Stranger is like, it's admirable but certainly not much fun. You feel ennui that book.
I think it's great. He's looking forward to being you know greeted by crowd that's cheering with hate, you know. It's awesome, it's fantastic.
it's a great little book. I don't know that I'd read it again for pleasure, but I would like to come back to The Plague. I'd like to come back to The Plague with, you know, a better sense of, with a little bit better of a critical faculty than I had when I was 24. I was talking to a friend of mine last night about, she asked what the podcast was going to be, and I told her what we were going to do, and I guess she told me that she had read The Stranger in high school, and it had so much of an influence on her life that she thereupon resolved to be a diplomat who worked in Northern Africa and went so far as to did some university study directed toward that. I didn't end up with that career, but that was like an aspiration she had for a while based on reading
The
Stranger.
Awesome.
Which, yeah. I have to admit that's not a response that I would have personally had to reading The Stranger, but I admire that she did.
Well, you know, The Stranger was the first novel of Camus, first thing I ever read by Camus, and it definitely had a massive effect on my life. You know, I think I was already like an atheist who like thought the idea of God was ridiculous and thought life was meaningless. I think I already thought all that, but it was pretty fantastic to encounter something that kind of spelled it out and helped, you know, make it concrete in your head so that you could understand yourself better. So I would say that's the effect it had on my life. But I did not think that I should go to Africa. I thought I should go at that time. I thought I should go to Japan and teach English in Japan. But that didn't happen. His life's.
I thought you did.
I visited for 2 weeks. I didn't live there. My original plan was to get a job as a teacher in Japan, and live there. And I actually did get the job. I interviewed, got the job, but the company that I got a job with folded before they ever shipped me off. And that's actually, it's better to fold before they ship you off, because I remember reading about how people who worked for the company, you know, they left their living units that day, took the train to work, and the doors were closed, and, you know, they just had to figure out how to get back to their respective countries, you know?
Wow.
So, yeah.
Yeah, we're going to go down the rabbit hole of living overseas anecdotes now. Maybe that's not for the best, but very interesting book. I hope I will reread it at some point in the future and maybe get a little bit better sense of it. Maybe even in the near future. I mean, there's not much to it, you know, time-wise.
Right, yeah, super short.
I can dip back into it.
Chris, before we totally sign off, did you have any final thoughts? I feel like you were pretty quiet this time around.
I guess especially because I think maybe the first thing that you ever told me, or like one of the first things that I ever learned about you, Patrick, was how much you loved Camus, and not having a whole lot of experience with Camus, in fact none before this. I was just mostly curious to ask questions, I guess. I don't know. Like, I enjoyed the book a lot. I did feel... I did have another question. Are his other books written in a similar style with an interlocutor? I mean, this isn't necessarily second person, but it...
No.
Where there is a narrator speaking to somebody else?
There's a story in his collection of stories, Exile in the Kingdom, called The Renegade, that is told in a similar manner. There's no interlocutor, but it is a first person, like, talking to not talking to someone, but it has a very conversational tone and feel. So I would say The Renegade is very similar.
This is almost like a dramatic monologue. It's like a Browning.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And I would say that The Renegade is similar in that it is like a dramatic monologue. And that's actually my favorite story from Exile in the Kingdom.
I guess, like, attached to that question, because you mentioned, and me reading this for the first time, I was wondering if Jean-Baptiste was a mouthpiece for Camus, but you talked about his unreliability, and I wondered how that stylistic choice fit. If there was a way to sort of talk about that as a philosophical and a stylistic
choice. So one thing that Fellman mentions, and I think this resonates, is that so in the quarrel with Sartre, which basically so Camus wrote this book length philosophical essay called The Rebel, which has a lot of it has a lot of insight. It has some amazing ideas. It's also, you know, it's also pretty, I guess, convoluted is the word. Like, convoluted is not the word. It's very unsystematic, but not in a good way. Like, Nietzsche is unsystematic, but that's like part of his system. This is unsystematic in a way that it's like he should be putting, he should be, yeah,
it's sloppy.
It's sloppy. It doesn't do a good job of arguing for and proving the main claims that it makes, even though the main claims that it does make are pretty interesting and insightful. So, and it's wandering and random. So it's not a great work. And, you know, Sartre and de Beauvoir and other people knew that it wasn't a great work. And that came out in the publication, in Sartre's publication. But it was also, you know, but as Feldman says, even though The Rebel is not a super great work, you can still understand Camus' main claims. And one thing that Sartre and his team did was they kind of really ignored even talking about Camus' main criticism, which was that Stalinism was, you know, it's like it's creating concentration camps, you know, like how can you pretend not, you have to respond to this. You can't just pretend that Stalin, you can't pretend that the existence of concentration camps in a so-called Marxist state doesn't have some comment on Marxism, was his position. Like you can't pretend that. And it seemed like they did. They just kind of ignored that. And so maybe, and this is just, you know, I'm doing this ad hoc, but maybe the fact that the interlocutor is never heard and that it's all one-sided, it's all Jean-Baptiste, maybe that's referring to this this idea of not hearing, not willing to listen to or not willing to understand those people you engage in dialogue with. Hmm. If that makes sense.
It does, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a nice little key, actually. I feel like this probably helped me more than I expected to in feeling like I somewhat got
awesome.
This work.
Awesome. So it's like almost as good as the Naked Singularity podcast, which Chris wasn't a part of. Right?
Right.
I think, yeah, the key to a podcast functioning is me taking as little or no involvement.
Yeah, it does.
It does possible.
Seem like Hans and I talk more than you do.
No, I was fine. You guys hit a lot of what I was curious about.
Well,
so.
That's not always true. Like when it's your book, like Gilead, you talked a lot.
Right.
So, and I talked less. So yeah.
Speaking of which.
Yeah, or it's not Hans's turn. It's Christopher's turn, right?
Yeah.
Is that what you're segueing to?
Is
Hans?
That where we're?
That is what I was trying to
say.
Yeah.
To okay.
You. I thought it would be funnier if I could segue to it right after Chris said that podcasts were better when he had as little involvement as possible. that would have been better.
Oh man,
timing,
yeah, I fucked that up. I screwed that up for you.
It's fine. Dante's Disneyland Inferno.
All right,
sorry, let me say that again. Dante's Disneyland Inferno.
Have we?
By the Sun City Girls.
Oh, so this is that music. That album?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you can purchase it on Bandcamp. And I'll, if you want, I can send you a link to the Bandcamp that you can buy it off of.
All right. Dante, Sun City Girls, it is. Like, so we'll be... You wanna give me some direction? Like what we're...
Well, I'm curious what Hans thinks, too. Like... I wonder about like focusing in on because it is really, it's a double disc album and
yes.
It's a lot, even though you could listen to it in far less time than if you were to like listen to a novel. There's so much, each track is very different, and is doing a very different thing. So Hans, like my mind goes to like the, the geography of the swastika. Should we focus on a few specific tracks?
I'll tell you what. That might not be the worst idea. That might not be a bad idea. But how about this, Patrick? Try to listen to it one time in the most concentrated, uninterrupted way that you can.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
Where you're, and it doesn't have to be every time, right? Like, once you've really paid attention to it one time, you can have it on as background a bit more and listen to it a bit more like you would other music. But if you just try to listen to it like you would most other music the first time through, it's going to be a hard sell. Like, listen to it the way you'd listen to, like, an episode of This American Life or a podcast or something, right? Where you're, like, trying to minimize other distractions.
I listen to music, I always try to concentrate on it.
Okay.
Listen to music as background noise. I usually only listen to music when I can pay attention to it.
Okay, good. Well, you're well suited to approach this album. Then do that one time. Do that one time, and then once you've done that, we can try to coordinate to see if either there are a few large scale questions that address the whole work that we want to try to talk about, or if we want to narrow in on specific songs to try to address. I know that you had brought up the idea before of, one of the two of you had brought up the idea of trying to approach whether or not song lyrics can or should be addressed as literature.
Yeah, that was me.
And that might be... Mm. That might be one potential entry point to thinking about this work. I mean, since then I've been thinking a bit about why it is that some song lyrics are and aren't, and what it is, like, the kind of popular conception of what we mean when we say that something is literature, but I don't really want to dig into that here and now.
All right, sure.
Let us know when you feel like you've had a good run through the whole album.
How many, you said it's double-sided, how many minutes is it?
Oh, it's long.
Both, it's like, it's two full
2 hours.
CDs. It's about
160 minutes.
I'd say like both discs. 140 probably.
Okay.
Give or take, yeah. It's a significant time investment.
Okay, what I should do is set down 2 hours and 20 minutes, and just pay attention to the. Give it like one whole listen through. Don't listen to it like 30 minutes at a time and then 30 minutes later on. And
no, you can split it up. Mm. You can split it up.
Yeah,
it's very episodic.
Yeah, it doesn't build on itself. Yeah.
It doesn't have like a narrative through line, so you aren't really going to miss anything if you listen to like... What I would probably encourage is like listen to the first disc, give it a little time, and then listen to the second disc. I wouldn't do the whole...
Yeah.
I wouldn't do the whole 140 minutes in one long sitting.
And if it helps you, like maybe, because I find it really hard to pay that amount of attention to something that is so fragmented and honestly strange. It's a very strange work. If it helps, where you just sort of like listen for one or two tracks that like catch your attention. In each of the discs, I know that Hans is maybe more capable of listening to the whole thing through and grasping and thinking about each track individually. But recently, when Hans first introduced it to me, I honestly couldn't listen to it. I couldn't do it. Like I couldn't make it
sounds,
through the whole
like
thing.
Sounds like the band Phantomas. Either you guys heard of them? They do.
No.
Yeah, Mike Patton and Eduardo.
Oh, it's a Mike Patton thing? Yeah.
I've never really tried to listen to it. I went through a phase recently where I did actually go through and really dig into a lot of the Mr. Bungle stuff that I'd never really tried to tackle, and I meant to do more Mike Patton beyond that. I've always loved Faith No More, and I got somewhat into Mr. Bungle, but I kind of stopped there. I meant to try Tomahawk and Phantomas, but I just... My attention got shifted.
Yeah, Phantomas did this album called, I forget what it's called, but it's meant to mimic a soundtrack. There's no, it's not a soundtrack to any movie. It's just meant to mimic it. So it's it's very fragmented, and it's like horror inspired. Super weird. Super weird. Anyway. Okay. Cool. I will listen to this and read the lyrics, and you know, here in a couple of weeks or 3 weeks, depending on our schedules, we can chat about it. Okay. Okie doke. Hey, gentlemen, as always, it's a pleasure to talk with you. See you next time. Peace out, everyone.